So we were talking about quotations 30 and 34, especially. In both those quotations, I've underlined the words independently given, among others. We're trying to understand, what does independently mean? He's saying, the mistake is an impossible separation. There's a view of how sensibility and understanding come apart, which involves their holding their separate in a way that they're not. He thinks it's wrong to think you can have one without having the other. The assumption of an ontological separation of these aspects of cognition, he thinks, is the common mistake of the rationalist empiricist. But he still thinks he needs to claim they are in some sense independent, or he'd be in big trouble. And the reason to look at this is to get a sense of what kind of problem Kantians are going to get themselves into, and also to see how this relates to the Cartesian problem. So, what does independently given mean? Well, in 34a, in that quotation, sorry about the strange numbering, I realized I was missing it later, he realizes that he needs a claim, and this is how he puts the claim. The pure concept, that is a kind of concept we have independently of our experience, and he thinks we must have some. This is what he thinks Kant thinks the categories are. The pure concepts and the content of the given are mutually independent. Neither limits the other. So we always have both. We can't have one with the other. They are, as he keeps putting it, interwoven in experience. But still, if we understand the nature of each, we must see that neither limits the other. He thinks he has to claim this, or he'll be in trouble. So, Lewis still holds a version of what I'm going to call a two-stage model of Kantianism. The point of introducing a terminology of a two-stage model of Kantianism is to try to bring out, for all of the differences, a structural homology between the kinds of Kantianism we're looking at today and the kinds of Cartesianism we looked at in earlier classes. The details are different. That's part of the whole point of this class. But there's still something structurally similar going on. In all the kinds of Cartesianism we looked at, we saw there was a gap, and a near side and a far side of the gap. And that one side of the gap always had to do with the mind, or contents that only a thinking being could enjoy, like, say, intentions, meanings, or aesthetic significance. And the far side of the gap was always something like the world as it is in itself, apart from conscious beings. You might call it the natural world, most interesting of the natural. So it was what's outside my mind as opposed to inside it that's causing the perception. His body as opposed to his state of feeling. The mere marks or signs themselves as opposed to their meaning. The bodily movements as opposed to the intention that caused. Each form of Cartesian theorism, there was some gap like that. And we saw the Cartesian doubt always raised the question about how we bridge the gap. We also saw examples where the problem about what to bridge could involve starting on one side or the other side. But the structure of Cartesian problems is always one of bridging such a gap. Well, now we're talking about Kantianism. It has a different structure. That's part of my point. But there is, in these different kinds of Kantianism, still an issue now, not of two different realms, exactly, but in trying to understand how phenomena such as thought, experience, meaning, in this case, perceptual content, empirical content of experience, is possible. In the analysis of it, it looks like we need to break it up into elements. And it seems natural to construe these elements as in some sense involving stages. Stages of what itself is part of what's at issue here. But just to use a weasel word for a moment, let's say something like stages of processing. Stages of cognition. Now, we've seen different two-stage models. I've just mentioned three. There are many more possible than three. What I'm interested in is the structural feature of these views at the moment. One kind of two-stage model is what we might call a subpersonal model. They're the bare, uninterpreted data of sense. Those come in. Qua uninterpreted data, they're not recoverable in consciousness. That's sub-apperceptive, or that's, as they say now, philosophy of mind, cognitive, it's a stage of cognitive processing. subpersonal, modular, if you think it helps to use fancy modern language instead of old-fashioned philosophical language. And then there's what often gets called interpretation, or conceptualization, or schematization, or whatever you want to call it. And in very modern debates, this is often called something like, non-conceptual information and conceptual processing. If you want to use something more like Gareth Evans' way of talking about this. But so, there's a second stage, then, in which this is processed. And then this gives us a kind of content that can be true or false. And we can, if we're talking about perception, have as a content of experience that bears on the world. And we can think of it as being true or false and so forth. That's one kind of two-stage model, what I call the subpersonal model. Here's another kind. And there are versions of readings of Kant like this. Interestingly, they're mostly more recent. Well, Norman Kemp Smith, I think, is the first version of this. That goes back to the 30s in Scotland. But these have become much more fashionable. So a certain kind of philosophy of mind became fashionable in the English speaking world. So there's now people like Patricia Kitcher and people like that who read Kant this way. Second two-stage model, I think this is a more standard reading of Kant, both in the German and English speaking world, where the two stages represent temporally successive phases of the conscious process of cognition. So in this way of understanding, you have intuitions, you bring them under concepts. But there's some initial thing. You get into trouble with this as a reading of Kant, because then later on Kant says, the very unity of an intuition presupposes the logical functions of judgment. Looks like an important conclusion, the first half of the deduction. But then often what Kant commentators will say is, got to be careful, you got to draw a distinction between two kinds of intuition. There are the unconceptualized, bare intuitions. He was talking about those in the Transcendental Aesthetic. And then later on, they're the process, conceptualized intuition. Those are the ones he's talking about later. Problem with that is you start thinking about it, you realize you don't just need two kinds of intuition, you need two kinds of manifold, you need two kinds of synthesis, you need two kinds of rule, turns out, two kinds of everything. And he hasn't marked any of this. So the book starts becoming really hard to read, because you have to make it up. Oh, that's why we need commentators. That's one attitude. Another attitude is maybe we should start reading Kant again, see if we can do better. But at any rate, as a view, whatever its merits as interpretation, there's a second two-stage model, the temporally successive model. Third kind of two-stage model, this is all we need to understand Lewis, is Lewis's kind. These are not distinct temporal stages, they are not distinct levels of consciousness, but nonetheless, he's trying to make a weak a claim as he can, because he knows full well that the other versions get into trouble, both as interpretations of Kant, and especially as views. In fact, he thinks they're views Kant criticized, and I think he might be right about that. So Lewis is trying to view all the problems of other two-stage models, but still have a version of a two-stage model. He thinks you're supposed to have some version if you're a Kantian. So he wants these, what I'm calling two stages, to represent something like analytically, not temporally independent moments of cognition, which always co-occur in consciousness, which are always interwoven. But nonetheless, what always thus co-occurs, we must see as such that the pure concept and the content of that which is given do not limit one another. Why does he think he must say that? Because of what he says in 34b on your handout. If he didn't say that, there was no datum given to the mind in his sense of given, then knowledge must be contentless and arbitrary. There would be nothing which it must be true to. So he thinks the mistake of empiricism is to think the given can deliver more than it can without concepts. But there's a worry on the other side, a kind of vicious idealism, where if we say everything is shot through with concepts all the way down, then that structure of conceptualization we have isn't answerable to anything outside it. There must be some way which perception, experience, can serve as a tribunal, where we can take our picture of the world and, given what we experience, say, this is right and this is wrong. That's what Lewis thinks he has to be able to say. Now, as we'll see, this very feature of Lewis is something that McDowell and other authors we're going to read are going to criticize. But the point right now is just to see that all of these Kantians have some version of a two-stage model. And there's a worry on each end that's causing them to formulate the two-stage model in one way rather than another way. Did you have a question here?
No, just a remark. I think this sounds very, to me it sounds more Kantian than the other things, because...
Well, this is only supposed to be a specification of the thing you call the other
thing. Yeah. Kant himself used the expression the middle way, you know, and the Mittelweg.
Well, Kant criticizes the thing he calls the middle way. The middle way he associates with Crusius. That's the thing he's...
Yeah, but
what is true is critique is always a tribunal where we try to respect the claims of both sides.
Yeah.
But the way to do that isn't just to go through the middle, because that doesn't work. If you have a turn to the right, and a turn to the left, and you go to the middle, you just hit that pole with full force. That's what Kant thought. So the way to avoid getting split in half is not to just go up the middle. That's why critique is so difficult. So quickly move forward, please. So distinct, dependent, analytically independent, not temporally dependent, not temporal stages of consciousness. So in what sense independent? Well, how do we recover the independence? Not through introspection. We saw he thinks that's not going to work. Schlick is wrong about that, as he thinks many other philosophers are. Lewis's word, it's a word that occurs a lot in Kant, one might add, is abstraction. It's through a process of philosophical abstraction that we recover. We see that in order to give a coherent account of knowledge, there must be these independent elements. And we can cover them through a certain kind of exercise of abstraction. 38 on your handout. He's criticizing a certain reading of people like Fichte, certain post-Kantian idealists, Hegel. He says they're misunderstood because they're taken to deny the given as such. But he thinks good idealists aren't denying the given as such. They're denying that the given could ever be independently available in isolation from concepts. They're denying that the given is a separate element of experience which you could apperceive as such. Experience is shot through with concepts. You never have the given except conceptualized. Nothing is ever given except as this way or that way. And that always involves concept. But that's not to deny the given, he says. The given, he says in quotation, it's in quotation 38, he said, the denial of the given is not obviously necessary to any of the characteristic theses of idealism. Indeed, an unqualified denial of this element in ordinary cognition is sufficient to put any theory beyond the pale of plausibility. And in the reply to Firth, the paragraph of that I asked you to read for today, you have this even stronger. He's reading Firth, who's partly influenced by Sellars, who's criticizing Lewis's notion of the given. And Lewis feels like, you must have misunderstood me. You understood me. You see, you can't deny the given. And there he says, you know, there's different things we could call this. In grandmother's day, some people wanted to call this sense data. We have to be clear what this means. But to deny the given as such would qualify one, he says, as a candidate for the booby hatch. The given is, there's something independent of me. In some sense of independent, we must be able to make sense of, which is the basis of my claims. If I just make claims and the only thing that supports my claims is other claims, if, as Davidson puts it, the only thing to justify a belief is another belief, and there isn't something further out there which gives us some friction on all that, then we're just like that guy who thinks he's Napoleon, and the men in the white suits are going to come take us away. So, qualify. So I just want to bring out the extent to which Lewis thinks he's making a very weak claim. He thinks you can't, he's just trying to get the minimal sense of given, which he thinks you must admit. And it's not something you can isolate phenomenological experience, but by abstraction you can see it must be there. Then he wants to teach you how to do this. So, quotation 39, the given here conceived. Notice how different this is from anything Price could have said. If you just have the two quotations in the handout, you might not see how different there is. But you read this quotation, you won't find anything like this in Price. The given, as here conceived, is an abstraction. Unless there being such a thing as pure aesthesis, that would be something like pure passive taking something in without ascribing any concept to it. And I doubt this very much. The given never exists in isolation, any experience or state of consciousness. Any Kantian manifold, purely intuitive manifold, is a psychic datum, or a moment of experience, a temporally distinct moment, that means, is a fiction. And the assumption of it as such is a methodological error. The given is in, not before experience. So this is very different than Price. He's just going to characterize that which is given from that which is not. The red bulgy part, we don't know what's beyond it. No, he can't do that. Very different notion of the given. The elements, both the conceptual elements, that which is the contribution of the mind, and the sensible elements, that which is given, must be arrived at through abstraction, through a certain kind of philosophical reflection on the conditions of the possibility of knowledge. He takes this to be an understanding of what Kant's doing, appropriately liberated from a Cartesian framework. But Lewis does think, this is where he still has a two-stage model, that through an effort of reflective abstraction of the right sort, we can isolate that moment in our experience which is purely passive, which is simply that which is directly present, if you want, or product of sense. In some sense of isolate. Here's Lewis's first quick characterization of what we're trying to isolate. When we're trying to, as it were, abstract the given, what are we after? Quotation 40. There is in all experience that element which we are aware that we do not create by thinking and cannot in general displace or alter. At first approximation, we may designate it as the sensuous. So I see this as a Samsung mobile phone. Samsung mobile phone. Those are incredibly sophisticated concepts, actually. I drop this in front of a native of the jungles of New Guinea. He will not suddenly see a Samsung mobile phone. He might see a funny, smooth object. He might even think artifact, as opposed to something that grew in the ground. But not Samsung mobile phone. I look at it, I see a Samsung mobile phone. Gee, I see my Samsung mobile phone. Lewis will say, Samsung mobile phone are three concepts that I have acquired, which organize my experience. Yet I am aware of the fact that there's something in this experience which isn't just the product of my thinking. That I so experience this has something to do, which is something outside me, which is eliciting these concepts. It doesn't think I can give you words or a description for that which is unalterable in my experience. Any such description would involve concepts. Agrees with Schlick about that. But he also thinks there isn't any sort of, as it were, stratum, which you can sort of hear the way Schlick wants to really hard and get at the silver of the phone, which doesn't involve any concept. He doesn't even think that. But he still thinks, nonetheless, we're aware. He's trying to give you as philosophically unloaded a notion of given as he can. We still are aware that there is that which is given. That's the sensuous. Our senses are somehow beholden to something outside of us, which they are providing as material for conceptualization. And that is part of our experience of this, as opposed to, say, when I imagine a wonderful dog I had for 20 years that died 6 years ago, and I picture this, I call up a picture of this dog. I don't have a sense of that in my experience, which I cannot alter through thinking. There, I've called up the image. Here, there's an aspect of experience that exceeds the will. That's part of what passive here means for him. And he wants to somehow characterize that. Now comes, finally, quotation 41. Quotation 41 is also quotation 2 on the first page of your handout. It's the same thing. We just arrived at it through the Lewis. This is the thing I paired with the Price. If you just read this together with the Price quickly, you might think the same topic. In the context we've built up to it, we now see it's involved in a very different exercise than anything Price is doing. The point of this passage is not to help us see what is susceptible and what is immune to doubt, so we can raise a Cartesian problematic about what is really there beyond what appears. The project here is to try to show and try to get clear about what the given element experiences, and to isolate that and show that it's isolatable, where it has a character completely unlike anything Price has indeed. That's what he's trying to show us how to do. Pretend this is a fountain pen. This example is about a fountain pen. So, in both cases, there's an object, a tomato, a fountain pen. But I'm going to say they function very differently. Lewis's fountain pen is not a generic object. I will claim a little later. I have a fountain pen in my hand. We're at the beginning of your handout, right? Here's this handout. So we're either, depending upon which you like better, 41 or 2 of the first page. 2 of the first page is broken down into more than one quotation. It has some interstitial material now. So, 41. I have a fountain pen in my hand. When I so describe this item of my present experience, experience, by the way, is a word that could have gone in this as well. Present's already up there. Lewis is aware of this problem, so he will say, what Price is calling is what I'll call thin experience. That's not what we should mean by experience. We aren't capable of thin experiences, he'll say. Small children are. And the thing that Lewis describes, the thing Price describes, Lewis will say, is neither our thick experience nor something a small child could have, but a philosopher's invention. So I describe this item of my present experience. And when I do this, when I say fountain pen, I make use of terms whose meaning I have learned. He's making the same point about the fountain pen I made about the cell phone. Fountain pen too. You need to learn, you need a lot of concepts. You need the idea of writing, you actually need the idea of script, reading. Fountain pen is more in a particular kind of stift. Do we have a word for that in English? Writing implements. Instrument of inscription. We don't have a good concept there in English, I just realized. Do we? A different kind of thing to write with. Fountain pen. So, in order to see this as a fountain pen, I have to acquire concepts. Fountain pen itself, my experience of this qua fountain pen, involves much more than just the given. It involves conceptualization. Correlatively, in seeing this as a fountain pen, he says, I abstract this item from my tunnel field of present consciousness and relate it to what is not now present. Other pens, other things to write with, the way in which this has something in common with those is essential for my understanding this as a fountain pen. I don't treat experience as a bare particular, but it's related to other experiences that have a similar character in order to see it as a fountain pen. That's part of the reason it's not just given as fountain pen. Because it involves a relation to that which is not given. To see this as a pen too. I can't see this as a pen unless I can also know that other pens are cases of pens. So I'm immediately placing this experience in relation to other experiences. A Kantian point. That's part of what Kant means by saying concepts are medium and general. It's a generality in the content of my experience and seeing this as a fountain pen. And because he's a pragmatist as well as a Kantian, he thinks this has to do with modes of action, that it's something I could pick up and write with. My understanding of that is important. He says, it might happen that I remember my first experience of such a thing. So now, we're contrasting Professor Clarence Irving Lewis's present experience with this fountain pen in 1930-something with baby Clarence's first experience of this. Now, baby Clarence's first sight of the fountain pen, we're taking to be quite young, very few concepts of any, depending upon how much sense you think it makes to have a few concepts. Can you have three concepts? Can you have one? Is there a special number at which you start having them? And very few words, at least. There's also a question about what it is to have a word. When the child says, Mama, for the first time, does it have its first concept, the concept of a mother? So there are questions about baby Clarence here. But at any rate, we're trying to contrast Professor Clarence Lewis with baby Clarence. Let's call him Professor Lewis and baby Clarence. Baby Clarence, when he first had this presentation, Lewis says, presentation, when Lewis says presentation in a Kantian register, he's trying to characterize what is given independent of conceptualization. That's what the word presentation means to Lewis. It's what it means in a Kantian register. It's not something you can mean in a Cartesian register. Because you don't have the problematic to allow it to mean that in a Cartesian register. this sort of presentation did not then mean fountain pen to me. I bring to the present moment something which baby Clarence couldn't have been. This relation, all these actual possible experiences of other implements for writing, of reading and writing and those concepts and the activities they involve and so forth. A classification of what is here presented with things that I could not then, did not then include in that same group. The present classification depends on these things. And then there's a third example. Not baby Clarence, not Professor Lewis, but sort of an intermediate example. Somewhat politically incorrect way of describing this case, a savage in New Guinea. That person is an adult. Let's say he has a language, unlike baby Clarence. He has a bunch of concepts. But not fountain pen. Certainly not cell phone, if you think fountain pen isn't recherché enough. But I think fountain pen does just fine. We drop the fountain pen from the helicopter into the jungle. Our savage begins walking. He sees it. A little bit worried about that. What is that? Doesn't want to go right up to it. Approaches it carefully. Savage from New Guinea lacks those habits and interests. He can say things about it. I actually can't tell you what he can say about it. It's an important point. But maybe he has concepts for things like man-made, not plant. Maybe he's a little bit worried about whether it has certain magical powers. That might be an urgent question for him. Isn't for me. But he can bring it under concepts. He has an experience, he has a more determinate experience, Lewis would say, than the child can have. But his experience of it is quite different than Professor Lewis's. But now, here's the question Lewis wants to say. Lewis wants to say, there must be something which is common across those three experiences. Your baby Clarence, Savage from the beginning, Professor Lewis. Those three experiences, even here, Lewis is incredibly careful. He admits there's a bit of an idealization because their eyesight might be a little different. They're looking at a slightly different angle. Maybe the sun's a little brighter in the beginning. So there might be aspects of the sensuous field of experience that is slightly different. So he's not saying they're numerically identical experiences, but he wants to say there must be a sensuously, qualitatively common character that these three experiences have, which is the basis of the child experiencing it as maybe smooth, biteable, and the native experiencing it as extremely remarkable, maybe artifactual, maybe magical object. And the professor thinks, there's something which these experiences have in common. Lewis is very careful. He's not saying we can now recover an experience, some stratum of experience, which is that which those three have in common. We can't strip off fountain pen and slap on the native's concepts. The only concepts we can experience things with are our concepts. Try thinking with someone else's concepts. You can only do it if they're not your, if they're not just not yours. That is, your experience will have had to change in order for those concepts to be available to you. But he wants to say still, even though we can't describe what's in common, even though we can't recover experience, we can postulate, we must postulate, as a matter of philosophical necessity, a commonality across these three cases. So his attempt to isolate the given is not to give you an example of the merely given. He can't do that. It's much more complicated than that. So let's now look at the next quotation in your handout, 42. In whatever terms I describe this item in my experience, I shall not convey it merely as given. So he's not trying to describe the merely given. He can't do that. He's going to give you some concepts you and I share. If we don't share them, you don't understand them. And if we do share them, it's not merely the given. But I shall supplement this by a meaning which has to do with relations, in particular relations to other experiences. The infant may see it much as I do, much as, that is, there's something in common, but he will still mean none of the things to him I have described as being. It won't mean something to write with, for instance. It won't even mean something not to eat, unfortunately, if the infant's small enough. But for any mind whatever, it will be more than what is merely given, if it is noted at all. It takes this to be a deeply Kantian thought. If you've so much as noted it, if it can so much as figure as what Kant might call an element in a unity of apperception, then it's already more than a bare intuition. It's already more than something that's merely given. But this doesn't mean that there isn't, Lewis is trying to argue, against a certain kind of, he thinks, hyperpolization, misunderstanding, nothing given. There's something given, which he's trying to isolate through this thought experiment. We must, quotation 43. I hope it's clear that this passage can be read, among other things, as just a straight critique of the Schlick passages we have. So, quotation 43, we must distinguish the given from the object which is given. The given is presentation of something real, in the normal case at least. What is given is this real object. But the whatness of the object involves categorical interpretation. The real object is known is a construction put upon this consciousness of it, and includes much which is not at the moment given in the presentation. This is all to bring out how, in a sense, elusive given is. But nonetheless, he wants to say, if you keep reading, there is to be sure, 44, this is part of the original quotation in the first page, I think, something in the character of this thing as a merely presented colligation of sense qualities. That complicated mouthful is his attempt to give a philosophically unproblematic gloss on the given. What is given is a colligation of merely presented sense qualities, which is for me always the clue to the classification of meaning. Part of what Lewis is concerned with here in avoiding what I was calling vicious idealism is that there is something which is the basis of my using the concept, which guides the concept, which makes the use of the concept correct or incorrect. Thinks if we don't have that, we're in big trouble. There's going to be something that grounds our use of concepts that isn't itself merely part of the realm of the conception. Let's put this in McDowell's language to anticipate for our next class. He thinks the realm of the conceptual has to be constrained from the outside. The realm of the conceptual has to be understood as bounded. There has to be something outside of it which constrains our use of concepts. But he's very careful. If you read on in my quotations on the chapter, he'll say we cannot identify the given with what he calls an individual presentation. An individual presentation, he says, is an historical event and as such unique. If you're really, really careful, he thinks, you know, every time you look at this phone, it looks slightly different. The angle's different. The lighting's different. Maybe even the color has worn off a little bit. There's all kinds of ways. So it's not we're saying that they're exactly the same sense experience. So even at this level, it's not identity. Cartesian chromatic is always about identity. Here it's about a certain kind of numerical identity. And how do we tell whether these things are numerically distinct or not? Here there's an issue about there must be a qualitative similarity, which is the basis. There must be some way in which there are sense qualities that are the basis. There must be something the same about this experience of the cell phone and, close my eyes, open them, this experience of the cell phone, as opposed to close my eyes and this experience of the cell, I don't think so, that's not the cell phone. And the fact that I close my eyes is a mere abstract, we can eliminate that. Time is taking place here, as Kant is eager to point out. There is a basis which allows the continued application of a certain concept, which itself must guide that concept, which has to have a qualitative aspect, Lewis says, a sense quality. Lewis is incredibly clear about what this commits himself to. So what he says is that we need to distinguish, if you read on in the chapter, universality of concept from what he calls universality of the quail, plural, qualia, a word that's now very common in philosophy, coined by C.I. Lewis in this book, and mostly misunderstood. Lewis is using the word much more rigorously than people do now. That is, he understands how expensive this concept is. Most people talk about qualia, describe your qualia in ways in which Lewis would say, those aren't qualia. You've imported all of these concepts, your characterization of experience. Your qualia are a lot harder to get at than that. So he's going to have an immediate Kantian critique of the contemporary employment of the term. But people wanted it, something that he already wanted. That is, there has to be some generality or universality built into the character of experience that if it's going to guide our application of concepts, there's going to be a normative basis for using concepts that's correct or incorrect, which is not itself a condition of already having acquired the concept in question. Otherwise, we have this vicious circularity, which will leave all of our thought without content, he's afraid. So he distinguishes between what he calls the universality of the quid, or the sense quality, and the generality of concepts. This he sees. So you have Lewis at this point working very hard to try to say what the crucial assumption underlying a coherent Kantianism is he thinks people have missed. And if, unless you understand Lewis is making this claim, you won't understand what Sellars and people like that are criticizing. Because it's this distinction that Sellars is criticizing. That is, again, that next step in analytic philosophy depends upon this Kantian frame. The tendency is to pick up these books often and read them as they have a Cartesian problem, or just to make a big mess out of it. Lewis is incredibly clear about what this would involve, up to a point at least. So he thinks that there must be some sense in which there's a sensory capacity to recognize things as having the same sense quality, again, which isn't the same thing as recognizing things as the same, again, in the sense that they fall into the same concept. We talk about being the same again, or experience having a certain consistent character quality. You see, there's two different issues here that needs to be separated, Lewis wants to say. Yeah, in order to have experiences, we have it. We have to be able to acquire concepts like pen and use them and say, this is a pen. And concepts can be incredibly abstract. So you can have concepts like things that cost less than $100. And if you put them in a box, it might take a long time if you give someone the box for them to figure out what the common concept is, because they look really different. But then there's something else, which is that in virtue of which, for especially concepts that have a high degree of sensuous content, like red, there must be something which is the same again in the experience, in the sensory dimension of the experience, which is the basis of the application. It has to have that sense quality, repeat, and we must be able to recognize that. Zeller says the fundamental assumption of the myth of the given is that there are repeatable sense determinables. Things that are determinable, that is, there can be instances of them. They have a general structure. They're not fully determinate. Sense quality, this can be an instance of it, that can be an instance. They're repeatable, but they are simply have the structure they do, and we can recognize them as the same again simply in virtue of our being able to sense. That's the crucial assumption. And he's quite right that Lewis is making that assumption. Sellars wants to criticize it. Lewis is saying, you gotta make it, or you'll fall into vicious idealism. There's a lot more to say about Lewis, but what I want to do now instead, sorry that we didn't get further in the handout, the rest of the handout is really quotations where he's trying to flesh out this notion of a sense quality, which is what the given really is, and why we must have it, and why we can see we must have it, and what its character is, and all the things we have to do not to misdescribe, not to mischaracterize it. We better not identify it with a particular sense presentation. It's not particular, and so forth, all the mistakes. So let's now just quickly go back to the price, contrast the price and the Lewis, and I'll stop, hopefully close on time. And then if anybody has questions, I'd be glad to stay and talk about them. So, Price versus Lewis, these two quotations we started with, which I think if you just read them straight off, with all of this common vocabulary, it seemed to have a very similar topic. How do they differ? Well, here's something we can say about Price's tomato, that one can be said with equal justice about Lewis's fountain pen. When Price says, when I see a tomato, we haven't really understood what he's doing unless we see that has the force of whenever I see any object. And similarly for Lewis, when he says, when I see a fountain pen, it's not something special about fountain pens he's trying to teach us. I could switch to cell phones, it causes no problem. But another of the things you can say of Price's tomato, you can't say of Lewis's fountain pen. To borrow a phrase from Stanley Cavell, we might put it this way. For Price, The entire existence of the world is squeezed into that tomato. If it turns out I can doubt the tomato really exists, then I'm one short trapdoor away from the problem of the existence of the external world. That's not Lewis's issue. He's not worried about what exists. Does the fountain pen really exist? Never comes up. The word doubt is not organizing this discussion. So that you can't say of Lewis's fountain pen. So what's going to turn out to be true is that Price's tomato and Lewis's fountain pen each aspire in some way to be what we might put it like this, representative of the object of knowledge as such. But they aspire to very different sorts of generality. That's what we're trying to understand here. Price's tomato seeks to represent the object of knowledge in virtue of its alleged optimality. The tomato is right there. It's the best case we can tell tomatoes. If we can't get this one, how are we ever going to be able to, and so on. So its select is what I call the best case. The point of rolling it onto the scene is to see it's susceptible to doubt, and see what in one's experience of it isn't, and what the consequences of the doubt are. And its capacity for representativeness has to do with the repeatability of that performance with respect to any similar item. So its representativeness is a functional way it allows us to infer something about knowledge in general from the particular case of what we can doubt in our experience of the tomato. So, for instance, when people start criticizing Lewis to... When people start criticizing Price, to take a step further down the dialectic than we really have so far in the course, and start looking at criticisms of a Cartesian problematic, the kind of thing that somebody like Michael Williams or Charles Travis or Stanley Cavell, to name some very different people, would be worried about is, well, what kind of example is this? Is this really fully representative of knowledge? It seems to be very schematic. Knowledge claims are much more determinate. Can we give it the determinacy of a claim and still give it the representativeness that allows it to jump? These are the kinds of issues you get in Cartesian epistemology. There's all kinds of things that happen. But there's a way it starts going. Lewis, in his fountain pen, also, you might say, seeks to represent the object of knowledge as such. That's another one of these phrases that can work in very different registers. But now, in virtue of exhibiting what we may call the general characteristics which any instance of empirical knowledge must possess in order for it so much as to appear to be about something. The issue here is not the veridicality of the experience, but what it takes for it to be intelligible as experience of something. So, in this more specific kind of Kantianism, it's closer to Kant's text, but it can be Kantianism by my lights, even if the problematic develops quite a bit. Here, it's in virtue of the supposition, more specifically, that knowledge possesses a common structure, that it has a sensible aspect and an intellectual aspect, that it has a passive aspect and an active aspect, that it has an aspect which involves a cognitive relation to particulars, and an aspect which involves a cognitive relation to general structures that organize it, however you want to put it. And so now the fountain pen is selected not as a best case of knowledge, but as something that can figure as a coherent candidate. And the question is, what does it take to schematize it as that? As something that has a content that has bearing on the world and is vulnerable to truth or falsity. The issue about empirical content here is an issue about how it could be that I was wrong in thinking it. Just as, you know, how could I have a false experience? So it's not offered as an exemplary instance of knowledge, but just as a specimen, a sort of thing that can figure in a claim to knowledge, even a false one. And what's at issue for Lewis, unlike Price, is not the unimpeachable certainty of this. That's part of why he chooses a slightly more complicated concept, like fountain pen. And I can switch to Samsung's cell phone, and things go fine. Whereas in the Cartesian problematic, the more specific the object gets, the less well it works. The Kantian problematic, that's not a problem. Actually, the more specific it gets, the clearer it becomes that you need a hell of a lot of concepts in order to have that experience. So what's at issue here is rather simply what we might call the bare intelligibility of that which his experience presents it. So Lewis's example's capacity for being representative or for generality turns not on its being susceptible to doubt, but as we've seen, susceptible to a certain kind of abstraction. And then the argument in Kantianism is, what's the right way to abstract those elements? You know, if we want to say there are elements of cognition here, are we getting into physiology or not? Are we getting into temporal phases or not? Are we getting into certain... That's the kind of argument. It's a very different kind of structure of argument than you have in Cartesianism. In the Cartesian, what I call the Cartesian problematic. I'm not saying Descartes doesn't get into those kinds of issues also. But that's to say, Descartes is not only worried about Cartesian problems. So its representativeness is a function of the way conclusions about this particular candidate to knowledge flow from a consideration of what's constitutive knowledge in general. There's a lot more I could say about this, but let me just give you a couple of examples. So the first thing to say is that so we might distinguish between something we might call the Cartesian object, if you will, and the Kantian object. I tried to say a lot last class about the Cartesian object, or was it two classes ago? That is, that it has to be what I called a generic object. I made it clear that's not an ontological distinction, but are taking it up a certain kind of way. We might here also raise an issue about a Kantian object. And there, too, we'll see. It's not that the world divides into Kantian objects and non-Kantian ones. Anything can be taken up as that. Again, it's a matter of taking up an object a certain sort of way. But now the way of taking it up is quite different. I think I better stop because we're out of time. I'm sorry to have such a choppy ending. So let me say what we're going to do next time. What I want to do next time, is this right about the syllabus? Is we're supposed to read... McDowell for next time. So
I don't have a copy of my syllabus.
So I know what I believe I did. But being a good Cartesian, I know I can do it.
Yeah, that's this time. The next time is... No. On Friday it says varieties of skepticism.
Oh, that's great.
Part.
Yeah, I have more time than I thought. That's fantastic. Okay, good. That's good. Well, that's wonderful. I'm glad I have more time. I don't want to get too far behind the syllabus. So then, excellent. What I will do then is I will actually take the time to finish contrasting Descartes and Kant, the Cartesian and Kantian problematics that we have in Price and Lewis here. Once I've done that, then I will step back and we'll think about what this means for contemporary philosophy. I'll try to locate this with respect to certain issues in contemporary philosophy and also with respect to actual issues about what people mean by Kantianism. And then for the following class on Monday, we're going to be talking about we're talking about Putnam and then McDowell, I think, for a moment. That's right. And what I'd like you to do when you're doing that reading, in case you start doing it already, because we now have a lot of reading coming up, starting on Monday. So I urge you to start doing that reading now if you haven't, is look at some phrase like in Putnam, like when Putnam says things like, our cognitive powers are not directly in touch with the things themselves. Or what is given in experience is not, blah, blah, blah. A lot of the whole Dewey lectures is concerned with an issue about that. He's trying to attack a certain assumption, which he calls the interface assumption. If we have the interface assumption, then we cannot see that we are directly in touch and experience with the objects themselves. And the question is that a Cartesian problematic or Kantian problematic? While you're reading the Putnam, think about that. And don't take my word or anyone's word for it. Just see what you think as you're reading it. How is it organizing itself? And he also says, one of the things he wants to do is express his agreement with John McDowell. One of the things he's doing in these lectures is explaining what McDowell has taught us more clearly, because McDowell doesn't write so close. He's going to get it clear. Imagine someone saying, you should read Price to understand Lewis. I think it's clear in the Price, but it's the same issue. Some of you have read McDowell already, I know. As you read McDowell, then read it against the Putnam and try to see to what extent they're talking to each other. I think it's an extremely difficult issue. I don't mean to say it's obvious, but since I want you to be reading this reading already, please think about that. Anyone who would like to stay, please stay. You've been very patient, Paul. Anyone who'd like to go, feel free to leave at this moment.
I was asking, how deep do you think the ontological differences between Lewis and Kisser's position? Because asking
Lewis and Kassirer's position, so the two kinds of Kantianism.
Yes, you know, because Goodman takes a similar vision of Kant and tries in the structure of appearance to make a sort of new system for the folio. And he tries to do it by making only internal restrictions on the epistemological foundation to give the descriptions of the folio. But when pushed by the realists, and as he has done by Israel Shepherd, he has to admit there is something sort of a substratum. Though he says it is devoid of any form of matter, ordering, and time, he still has to admit the existence of a substratum, as in the same sense as Lewis. So, as I see it, the only difference between the Kassirian position and a Lewisian position is that the Kassirer can admit plurality in the problem of construction, while Lewis has said one kind of problem.
Well, you're assuming that, this seems to be a premise of the way you said the question. Kassirer and Goodman are quite close. The only difference between Goodman and Lewis is such and such. Therefore, Kassirer and Lewis must be quite close. That looks like the structure of your argument.
Yes.
Okay. I think there's a lot to talk about there. I don't think Kassirer and Goodman are close at all. So that's one thing to talk about. Another thing is that Goodman actually is a student of C.I. Lewis's. There's a direct affiliation there. I mean, maybe it's worth saying. I meant to say this earlier, but you see how little time there is. C.I. Lewis is kind of an interesting figure. In the 1930s, 40s, early 50s, he was the most famous professor of philosophy in America. And he was the professor at Harvard, which at that point really had a lock in American philosophy. It was the philosophy department. And people who got jobs were the people who were students at Harvard. It was sort of, there were a couple other schools that tried, but it was sort of the Oxford, Cambridge of American philosophy at that time. And Mind in the World Order is basically the text of the basic course that Lewis gave, his graduate seminar, which people took. So American philosophers, Quine, Goodman, Cavell, Stroud, you name it, from that generation, they got their degree at Harvard, as most of the famous ones did. They took Lewis's course. So, and they were students of his. So he's a very interesting figure to read, because you have kind of the background of American philosophy. There's a further interesting question, which is, I bet many of you, and maybe all of you, had never heard of C.I. Lewis before he signed in this class. So it's an interesting fact that he's also not read anymore. He's sort of fallen off the earth. So he's both tremendously influential. The most famous philosopher of his day, and quite forgotten. And it's kind of an interesting question how that happens. So Lewis was a student of Goodman's. He is both influenced by Goodman, as you say, he uses the word qualia. He means to be... He means to be building on Goodman's ideas. So he really does want to take seriously the idea that there is a kind of generality or universality, or there is a kind of structure to the sense aspects of experience, such that they can bear on each other in a way that can give us something that has a certain character before concepts come into play. Appearance itself has a structure, we might say. To summarize the title of the book. So actually, Goodman here is quite close to Lewis. He's a student of Lewis's. He's actually trying to, in that book, he's actually quite critical of his early book later on. Goodman undergoes a fundamental shift. But this is very, the structure of appearance is essentially a kind of revised version of Goodman's PhD thesis. So this is, he's still close to his doctor father. It is partly an attempt to sort of take the end of Chapter 2 of Lewis, which is really pretty hand-wavy, frankly, and really sort of say this is how it works. Now, there are differences, but with respect to how high we've got the helicopter, he's very close to Lewis. He's trying to flesh it out. He thinks part of what he's taking seriously is that the thing that has the structure is sense qualities. It's qualitative. So it's a critique of a certain traditional empiricism that's trying to understand impressions themselves as particular. There's that aspect that he's keeping from Lewis. How it's going to work involves some criticisms of Lewis and how to draw the line. But what Kassirer would say, very quickly, I think, about both of them, which I think you can even get out of that one quotation, is that what Kassirer would deny is that you can have recognition of sense qualities independently of concepts. What Kassirer is going to say, what that kind of Kantian is going to say, a radically holistic Kantian. By the way, in this respect, Kassirer is in the same box as Sellars and McDowell. What I think all those thinkers are going to say from their different traditions, is that to claim that sense qualities themselves have universality built into them is to just push back one level, Kant's critique of empiricism. It's to, as it were, remain invulnerable to the letter of the critique, but to miss the spirit by pushing the problem one back. I'm not trying to take sides here, I'm just trying to bring out how different Kassirer is from Goodman. So what these thinkers are going to say is that what you're saying is that we can recognize these things as the same. And the question is going to be, what does it take to do that? What is it to recognize something as the same? That involves correctness and incorrectness conditions. To say recognize things as the same is that some ways of sorting things aren't the same, some ways of sorting them, they are the same. So if we have red, in order to say, red looks like it's a bad example. Oh, here we go. This is red. This is not red. There are correctness conditions on this. Kant's going to argue those correctness conditions require concepts. If you're somebody like Sellars, you'll think it requires language. But at any rate, all of these kinds of Kantians are going to think, in order to talk about sameness, you have to talk about sameness with respect to what? And in order, things can't just be the same. Any two things, I mean, are these the same? And the answer is yes and no. Some respects the same, some respects not. So sameness is, as Frege would have said, a second order concept. There has to be a first order concept in play, with respect to which we're saying these two things both fall under that concept, to say they're the same. So if we think carefully about what this idea of sense qualities involves, such that we can say we can these things fall under the same sense qualities. So you say that involves correctness and incorrectness conditions. And they're going to argue you can't get correctness and incorrect conditions merely through the operation of sense, mere sense itself. Any two qualities that come in, any two, as Lewis would say, sense presentations that come in will be the same and different in many respects. There isn't a fact of the matter built into the presentations themselves such that they both fall under a quality or not. So they're going to deny that you can have a kind of universality that attaches to sense qualities that's independent of the kind of generality that Kant thinks has to be in some sense constructed. Whether it's constructed by the mind or it comes with language or whatever, that depends upon your kind of content. I think Sellars and McDowell are going to think this has to do with language. Kassirer wasn't much interested in language, but he would think it involves the interpretive capacity of the mind. And he's very interested in symbolic forms. And he's going to think there's some symbolic content that must be in play, is how Kassirer would put it in his idiom, for you to even have universality of the quill. So he's going to deny that somebody like Goodman's project could work. He's not close to Goodman. In this sense, Goodman is still a student of Lewis. They have their differences. They get bigger as they go along. But there's an assumption at this point in Goodman's career that he's making that the kind of radical holism you have in Kassirer's view won't let you make. And the way to put the assumption in terms of the beginning of my talk today would be to say, we still have a two-stage view here. We're trying to give a certain structure to appearance or structure to sense to that stage of cognition, the sense, the appearance. It's independent of this stage. And that's what Kassirer is denying. He's saying, these are self-determining moments. You can't have this universality without its cooperation. That's the point to Kassirer's view. So there's lots of things we could say, but I don't accept the idea that Kassirer and Goodman are of a piece. I think they're very different kinds of philosophers. I think you're right. What I think is fundamentally right about what you're doing is to see there's a structure here where there's a kind of philosophical problematic. They're all participating. That is, to put it, you know, in the sort of lingo of the course, in this sense, what is absolutely right about what you're saying is that Lewis and Goodman and Kassirer are all concerned with a common Kantian problematic. And there's something very similar about their issues, and they can be aligned with each other. What I'm resisting is exactly how you align them. But in that respect, they're all extremely different from somebody like Price, or Bertrand Russell, or Jean Moore, or A.J. Mayer, or Jean-Paul Sartre, all kinds of people have a more closely Cartesian formulation of what they think the fundamental problem is. And so this kind of vocabulary in Goodman is functioning in much the same way. I think you're quite right about that. But I do think the gap between somebody like Kassira's view and Goodman's view is quite large. And also, it's another interesting fact that Goodman read Kassira and his stuff about symbolic forms and got very, this is the coincidence, and got very influenced by it and other things. Also read Sellars and Sellars' Critique of Lewis. And Sellars' very first published article is a review of a book by Kassira, just translated into English. So there's an interesting sort of coincidence in the background here. So I do think part of Goodman's break from Lewis and his own early work in the structure of appearance and his thought that symbolic systems are at the bottom of all structure, not something he thought. He thought the structure of appearance had a non-symbolic basis, involves the influence from Kassira. So I think later Goodman is much closer to Kassira and is also influenced by it, but not the structure of appearance.
Well, as I read the structure of appearance, I can see that he admits the two-step gap that you find in Lewis. I think if he was asked how he would read the account at that time, he would also read it just the same as you said Kassira. He does not at any point in structure of appearance except that there is an ontological basis, fundamental, that gives a sort of...
No, it's not an ontological basis. It's not that it's an ontological basis. The question is, can you sort... There's no ontological basis for any of these people. We're not talking about an ontological issue. The question is, what does it take to sort a sense quality? Can you open your eyes and sort them based on their merely sensually qualitative aspect? Is there such a thing? Which is it, what induces a structure? Or is that always an artifact of principles of sorting that are independent of the structure of appearance, in his sense? That's the question. The question is, he does this sorting. He helps himself to it. And the question is that something you can just do because you have a certain capacity for sense? Is this just a structural appearance? Or does it take more in order to be able to do that? That's the question. So it's a question about the exercise of our capacity for recognizing things as having the same sensuous quality. That's the issue. It's not an ontological issue. It's an issue of, as it were, the structure of cognitive capacity. And the question is, do we already have to master very symbolic systems that seem to have nothing to do with that in order to be able to do that? Or is there such a structure which itself belongs to the sensory appearances of things, such that any being that has sensory appearances, they have that structure? So this book can be about the structure of appearance as such. It's not about the structure of appearance given that we have these symbolic systems. For later Goodman, I think, there couldn't be a book called The Structure of Appearance with the definite article in the title. There could only be, if you will, A Structure of Appearance. it's the definite article versus the indefinite article, what the difference is about. It's not an ontological issue. It's an issue about what's presupposed. And if what's presupposed is further capacities, then these capacities turn out to be more parochial than they look. But it's very easy to fall into the view that there's something about red things that we can just see. I mean, the way to put it, I mean, here's, I think, a very good way to bring out the assumption, which is very tempting, which is to think something like, a child opens his eyes and sees something. I look at the same thing, I open my eyes and see something. But I have certain concepts, so I describe that, which I can see and the child can see, with those concepts. But if I didn't have my concepts and I opened my eyes, I would see the same thing, in some sense of the same thing. And what Lewis is really busting his butt to do is to try to give content to that idea that the child, the savage, and I see the same thing without getting into any trouble. He sees that there are enormous pitfalls everywhere. He can't tell you what it is, he can't describe it, he can't say it, but there's still some notion of the same. Since the child and I see the same. And that's going to be the structure that appearance has, simply in virtue of his having a sensory quality. But what another kind of Kantian thinks reading Kant, is that what Kant's point really was is those very structures that allow a concept like the same to do anything already involves concepts, categories, which themselves involve, it's, you know, as Frege puts it, so, like Kant says very explicitly about existence, similarly here about sameness, it's a second order concept, and you have to have particular determinant first order concepts in play. And the question is, what are those? And you don't get any of those for free. I have different ones than the savage, and the child has almost none. And so the idea of there being something that's the same disappears. The experience itself, on this view you're committed to saying, is completely different if you have concepts which construct your experience. There might be something about the causal antecedent that's the same, but there isn't anything at the level of sense quality that's the same anymore if you have this view. That's what the disagreement's about here, I think. So it's an issue about how, a way of putting it that Sellars puts it, which I think is quite useful, is to think of it in terms of a distinction between unacquired capacities and acquired capacities. There's some sense in which the ability to sense is an unacquired capacity. You have it, animals have it, children have it, you're born with it. You didn't have to learn a lot to sense. You know, pain is the clearest case of this. You slap the baby, as soon as he comes out, he cries. He's got some capacity for sense right there. And if he doesn't, we're in big trouble. He goes straight into the incubator. So some capacity for sense looks like it's an unacquired capacity. It's also quite clear that perceiving this to be a Samsung mobile phone is an acquired capacity. All kinds of learning had to take place. And then, that's a very schematic divide. And the question is, what falls on what side of this? And the tendency among the empiricists, the classical empiricists like Locke, was to think simply in virtue of your unacquired capacity to sense, you could have an impression of red, for instance. Now, it's very, by the time we get to someone like Kant, it's extremely clear to some philosophers that that's not going to work. Red has very determinate boundaries. You know, the English word red signifies a concept sense set. Once you get to orange, it's not red anymore. But you could, you know, you could have another concept such that the color spectrum was divided in a different way. And there are different color words, not all translatable into other languages. I can teach them to you. We don't always have a word for them. Some languages have more color concepts than others. I mean, famously, Eskimo languages have a hell of a lot of words for shades of white, having something to do with the fact there's a lot of snow in their world. So not red. We can't have an impression of red. But then the tendency is still to say, there's an impression of something such that we then learn to call that or things like it, where like, you know, has different boundaries, red. But there's that which we have in common. And then how do you get at that? And Lewis is working hard here to hang on. He thinks you got to hang on to that intuition. Lewis thinks if you give up that intuition, you're in big trouble. Because there's nothing that grounds your concepts. So Lewis thinks, and I think early Goodman is still a student of Lewis in this respect, that there is some structure of unacquired capacities such that there are these qualities, and they have something which is the structure. In this sense, you know, ways of world making has a plural in the title. The structure appearance has a singular. That's connected with a deep change in Goodman's views. There are, you know, the thing he was calling the structure appearance by his later view is just a way of world making. There is no. But at that point, he still thinks there is a kind of recognition of qualities, and he's trying to map that space. But there's one of those. And they're the things that, now he knows it's not red, he's a student of Lewis. He also knows it's not particular. They have to acquire, and he's trying to do this very carefully. That's part of the difficulty of that book, is to work this divide that Lewis has presented. And there's brilliant philosophy. I think it's a great book, actually. He's finding structures of coherence, the way in which things can become collections that have a certain kind of structure, without it obviously just being cases of this. That's what he's trying to do. But But that's what the debate's about. People like Kassirer, Sellers, McDowell, for different reasons, but all with a common sort of structurally common reading of Kant, which is different than Lewis's, because Lewis is, in some sort of way, clearly a Kantian too, trying to be Kant. They're all going to say, you know, if you understand Kant, Kant's point is that you can't have sameness. You can't have structure. You can't have the structure, let alone structure, without acquired capacities, that is, without the spontaneity of the intellect involved. And so they're not going to allow this distinction. But it's not an ontological distinction. It's an issue of the independence or non-independence of these capacities. That is, what goes into making experience intelligible. I think the ontological issues are the ones you get into with the Cartesians. The Kantians here are not arguing about an ontological issue about what exists. They're arguing about what does it take to have a structure? Even a false structure. And one of the things that Lewis is suggesting, and very early Goodman is trying to spell out, is you can have a structure of appearance. You can have that as such, self-standing. And then these people are going to argue for different reasons. You can't have that. And I think, actually, Goodman very quickly comes to convert with respect to this issue to the other side. That's what the debate's about. There's no ontological disagreement at all. There's no ontological issue. But one of the reasons I think these things are easily misunderstood is because you can put it into a Cartesian dress. So you can think, the structure of appearance has something to do with appearance, phenomena noumena. I think phenomena noumena means something like the veil and what's on the other side of the veil. So then we've got a whole ontological issue going, but it's a complete misreading. And all of these Kantians will think that's a misreading of Kant. Your hand is up, yes.
That might be a misreading of Kant, but that's not a misreading of Goodman. For Goodman, it is an ontological issue, as he says in epistemology and ontology, more or less.
Right. But that's for a specific issue. That's the influence of people like Quine on Goodman. It has to do with his early nominalism. So
yes.
For Goodman, to be is what you can quantify over. So if you can tell a story about this kind of structure that's self-standing, you need these qualities in the description, so you're quantifying over them. Then he'll say, they exist. But what I meant by an ontological, so you're right about something. But what this shows, thank you, is that this word too, you know, could go on this list of things that move in different renditions. I'm sorry, I was using the word ontological the way I was using it when we were discussing Cartesian issues, which is that you have a certain kind of appearance of what seems to be the case, and you want to know, is that really there? You know, I know it seems to be there, but is it really there? Whereas here, the issue is, what kind of structure must be in place such that things can have a certain kind of character? Now, what's true is, after Quine makes a certain kind of move in philosophy, Quine thinks these ontological issues are stupid. This isn't the right way to raise ontological questions. So, once something happens, There's a new way of asking something that you can call an ontological question in this format. But then the question is, first you have to figure out what the minimal structure is. And once you know that, the ontological question is answered for free. What you quantify over. In the Cartesian format, you know how things seem. And there's an ontological question that's completely independent of that, which is, what is there really? And that's a further question. There is no further really question. Goodman doesn't give us the structure of appearance and then say, but now, what of this really exists? That's not the kind of question he's interested in. So what you're right about, and I should have been more careful, is that, like the word epistemic, the word ontological, also occurs in post-late 40s, especially American philosophy. It becomes very important in Quine, early Goodman, especially David Lewis. But it's a completely kind of a completely different issue that's inscribed also within this Kantian format. That is, if you take what's called an ontological issue in the Cartesian format and what's called an ontological issue in the Kantian format, and you take people to be directly addressing each other, you'll be misunderstanding them. There's no question, Descartes, about what you can quantify over. I mean, there's a sense in which, insofar as that's an issue for Descartes, you know, the elements of res cogitans do exist, you know. The ontological question that people are worried about in Cartesian philosophy is, what is without the mind? That's not Goodman's question. Yeah, it's a terrible question. He's not interested in it. What he wants to know is, when we talk about stuff, what's the most fundamental description? Once we have that fundamental description, we have the predicate letters we can't do without. Those are the things we quantify. Existence is whatever we need there. What's without the mind? That's a stupid question. We don't need to discuss that. So it's a different. So that's all I was saying. He wasn't discussing this kind of ontological. But what you're quite right is that almost all the philosophical vocabulary can come back in a Kantian context. But then we have to see what the issue is.
Goodman does discuss the Cartesian ontological question with Esau Shapiro. So he takes up the question seriously, and he also admits that there must be a certain substratum, though pluralism in the way it can be formed, it has outer restrictions and higher constructive systems, because it finds that its internal constrictions, which is something actually nominalism and empiricism, is not enough to secure.
Right, but I also think once you have this exchange with, okay, good. I forgot you raised that earlier. I constantly try to keep the things simpler than I should, but that's fine. But I do think once he has that exchange with Goodman, which is after the books come out, it has to do with Scheffler, excuse me, that has to do with the reception
it's
of the book.
It's after Wizard World Machine.
Right. This is Goodman looking back over his career and trying to, as it were, fit his early book into his life's project. And I do think that's not an entirely reliable source for understanding what he's doing there, any more than if you read late Quine and early Quine. I mean, philosophers have a desire to see their work as of a piece. But what I do think is that it has no resources. I mean, because he's working, this is another thing I'll say quite clearly when we're looking at people like Putnam and McDowell. When I draw this distinction between the Cartesian and the Kantian format, I probably should have said this last class, but I ran out of time. As I say a little bit about this, I think, in the article I asked you to read, I say these are genres of skepticism, and this is an idealization. And it's idealization in various respects. So what I don't mean to be suggesting is any philosopher who writes takes himself to be squarely in one or squarely in the other. You often see philosophers who are trying to combine them. But my claim is, and I think this is a very apt case for applying it, is that where they're trying to combine these things, it's usually itself a sign of confusion. I'm trying to make that out specifically with respect to Kripke. So I think Goodman's inherited this problem from Lewis. He's trying to spell it out. It makes sense with a certain kind of Kantian format. Then, pow, he's hit with a question about Cartesian skepticism. And then he tries to answer it and fit it in. But I don't think it does fit. He's going to have a problem, which he's going to say, well, if we want to say this is appearance of something, and we want to understand appearance of something in a Cartesian terms, but there's something on the other side of an epistemic gap of a Cartesian sort, which causes this. Now, what can we say about what's on the other side? And he's going to have nothing to say about it. And Lewis would have said, you're changing the subject to even take up that question. The whole point. And Kant himself, actually, is trying to provide resources for saying why that's not a good question. But Lewis has inherited a certain problem within a Kantian frame. But he hasn't, I think, got a full overview of it. And so then he's hit with a certain question, he just tries to have an answer for that too. And we'll see this as Putnam has got himself in a version of this problem. So this happens quite a bit. So part of what I want to claim is one of the advantages of having an overview of a Cartesian problematic and a Kantian problematic is that when you're working at something, you're clear about what problem you're addressing when. So when people ask questions that seem pertinent, because they sound pertinent, they seem to involve the same words, you can say, that's actually a very different question about a very different issue, rather than just trying to shoehorn an answer into what you're doing. And that's why I think Goodman has so much trouble with that question. But I also think, back when he was a student of Lewis's, this is a guess, and he just sat in on Lewis's lectures, and he was working on this, he would have been a lot less inclined to take up that question. But decades later, trying to remember the structure of appearance and what he was doing, and Scheffler hits with this question, he tries to get it to fit. I don't think there's anything interesting to say, because there are no resources here for addressing a Cartesian question, because it's not a Cartesian problematic to begin with. So I think that's a very nice, I would use that as a case, possibly even a nice case, of the kind of thing I will try to give you other cases of in the next few classes, which is people that are trying to address a question using some of these words, sometimes trying to say something to the Cartesian skeptic and the Kantian skeptic at the same time, and actually equivocating on what their issue is. Now, I don't think that's trivialist. I don't think the structure of appearance has that problem. I think structure of appearance is actually quite a lucid book. But I think later on when he's asked that question and tries to relate the terms of that question to that Cartesian issue, at that point he's stuck with an equivocation about what the issue is. Even what a word like, I mean, this is another word that we could have put in the book, appearance is so much as about. Appearance here isn't, you know, appearance of something that's behind the thing that caused it. That's never the issue in Lewis. That's completely the issue in Cartesian philosophy. And that's the question he's letting Scheffler, you know, force on him there. Because, of course, this word too. This word is really just another word for this word. So I already have it on the board. And this word works quite differently, as I was trying to say, Cartesian content philosophy. But he's letting Lewis give him the word and then raise an issue that comes up with this word, which really functions in a different register when you have that question. That's exactly part of the point of this chart, ultimately. That's what I would want to say about that. But that's a large philosophical claim. What I've been trying to do, just to be somewhat more methodologically self-conscious for a minute, so what I've been trying to do is introduce these terms, Cartesian and Kantian, as things for describing philosophical issues. Look at certain discussions, now we're starting to look at more detail. See that they have these different structures, so they're really different. I haven't really made any claims yet, other than to say, here are descriptions of things. So the only way to really disagree with me is say, your description doesn't fit here, and that would be a problem. I'm just describing this. But I will want to claim at a certain point, once we have these tools, then we'll be in a position to go in and say, this is quite confused. But at that point, we're really doing philosophical work using these materials. But I haven't actually gotten to that point in the class yet. We'll be there soon. And that is the kind of claim I'm inclined to make about Lake Goodman trying to pick up Scheffler's question with respect to this extremely Lewisian early project of his. But I think that kind of confusion happens all the time. It's extremely easy to fall into. We'll see Putnam in a much more severe place. Putnam is not writing a book that has a certain structure, being asked a question and then answering when the subject may change. It's not clear what the subject is on the page. that can happen very easily. I think Kripke has a less severe version of this problem, but severe enough that I think people have very different readings of what Kripke's doing, depending upon whether they think Kripke's issue is, how can we tell whether he's adding or quadding? Can you tell whether he really means plus? That's a Cartesian issue. Or whether they think the issue is, how can there be so much as a fact of the matter about whether he's adding or quadding? That issue is, how is it so much as possible to mean something? What could it be to mean something? Is it a matter of all having the same dispositions, or all being in the same thing? And there's all these canned answers, none of which seem to work. So we have a Kantian boggle about how meaning is possible, not a Cartesian doubt about whether he means this or that, which presupposes there is something which is meaning something. So those are very different understandings of what Kripke's issue is. But they happen, because on the page, Kripke says things like, now it's impossible to tell. Now there's no way to tell whether he's adding or quadding, comma. There's no fact to the matter. So there's something that's presented as an apposition, like these are two ways of saying the same thing. But they're actually diverging into two philosophical problematics. The reason that's happening, I think, is because Kripke wants to be following Wittgenstein and explain what Wittgenstein's problem is. Wittgenstein's problem, I think, is a Kantian problematic, not about perceptual content in this case, but about semantic content, that is to mean something. But he also wants it to be a kind of skepticism. It's meaning skepticism. So he's trying to tell a story about this. It's a skepticism. And here's a certain picture of what skepticism is and how it works. And it's roughly the Cartesian format. Have a doubt about something. And those two things don't fit together. And so that's why he has these sentences that put it one way and put it another way, over and over again, these appositions. But what's interesting is that after he gave the lecture, and then he rewrote it into three lectures and he gave it again. Then he wrote this little introduction to the book, which is in the published version, which is the latest thing in the book. And there he says, this is his way of putting it, and I don't think this is completely clean way of putting it, but it's pretty good. He says, the epistemological way of putting the problem is actually just a ladder you climb up and throw away. So he started to realize, well, he motivates people by putting the problem in this Cartesian way, but he's actually interested in the Kantian problem. He says that explicitly in the introduction. But actually, if he took what he said in the introduction seriously, he'd have to rewrite the whole book. And at some point, at least later parts of the book, take out these sentences that have a Cartesian cast, because at some point we should have thrown away the ladder. We keep hanging on to the ladder. But so he himself actually becomes quite lucid about this, eventually. But in the book itself, in the lecture itself, you can really see him putting it in two different ways. So I think that happens all the time in philosophy. So I don't mean to say philosophers are either in a Cartesian problematic or a Kantian problematic. Look and tell. You always see they're of one sort or another. I'm saying, here's a certain kind of shape a philosophical problem can have. Here's another kind of shape a philosophical problem can have. Vocabulary can flow back and forth. The same sentence can mean something very different depending on which problem you have. But that means all kinds of things can happen. Like, people can think they agree with each other when they don't. Putnam and McDowell will be a case of that. People can think they disagree with each other when they don't. I'm going to offer you both Cavell and Kripke, and McDowell and Kripke, and McDowell and Cavell as examples of that. And also, people can be in both of those positions at once in their writing. That is, they can be moving back and forth. Because the sentences are lining up with the same words. Now, the Goodman case is much less extreme than that. It's just hit with this question that seems relevant many years later. He connects it as the same topic in his books. And I think he's not guilty of anything like the kind of confusion of the cases we're looking at here. But I do think there is a confusion. He's just accepting Scheffler's question as something his book, given its intellectual pedigree, is even supposed to be having an answer to. The good answer to that question would be, now, that's an issue of appearance that comes up in the context of a philosophical problem of a completely different shape. That would be the first thing to say. If you're Lewis or Kant, you might want to say more and say, and if you understand what I'm doing in this book, you'll see why that's not even an interesting question. That would be involved. That would take more resources. But so I agree with you that when he's answering Scheffler, he's answering a Cartesian question. But I'm not as embarrassed by that as I should be. Because part of what I want this for is to be able to say, people aren't always the judge of whether someone's in the same, something has the unity of a philosophical problematic is not that one author keeps talking about it all the way through. That gives philosophers more credit than they deserve. So one of the reasons I choose the authors I do, Putnam, Cavell, McDowell, the reason I chose those three authors is because we're going to look at a text by each of them, especially in the case of Cavell and McDowell, where at one point they're fixating on a Cartesian problematic. Another point, they're fixated on a Kantian problematic. Same author. So there's a real question about that author. How do these two texts fit together in their own thinking? So it's very important to me that it can't be a criticism to say, but, you know, Cavell or Putnam or McDowell is really Cartesian and not Kantian, really Kantian and not Cartesian, because over here he says such and such. We have to look a little further than that. But that's a coming attraction. I think I better stop. Thank you for your patience.